This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars episode number 6 was recorded on May 20th, 2019. JDI Research founder Juliet DeClercq joins me as today's All-Star interview guest. Juliet, Australian elections this weekend caught the attention certainly of Australians and a lot of people around the world because it was widely expected that the Labor Party was going to kick the incumbents out and that was going to be the new regime. And in fact, the incumbents won. And I think this relates very much to some of your views on modern monetary theory and populism. So tell us what's going on there.
Eric, yes, I think we've had another very interesting election result this weekend. As you said, the Labour Party was polling 3 to 5% ahead. And the fascinating fact is that the party, which was running on a platform of income redistribution and possibly higher taxes, actually lost. And the defeat, in my view, shows that concepts of equality and fairness are rather popular, but only until you throw in some specifics about the way socialism will basically be financed. So when the incumbent starts talking about higher taxes, it's very easy to strike fear into the holder of assets, the AVs. Suddenly, all aspirations for change and a social model that would eventually inject some dynamism into a struggling economy, e.g. via lower inequalities, disappear. And the fact is that the fear of the unknown is indeed a very powerful force towards keeping the status quo. I find these subjects really important given the prospect of, for example, Jeremy Corbyn grabbing power in the UK, and obviously also in light of the key 2020 election in the US. In fact, to answer these legitimate concerns, I've written a report in March, which was entitled, "What If Socialism Had No Fiscal Cost?" It was indeed received with great skepticism, and my goal was to answer the question on everybody's mind. Is fiscal expansion a viable means of supporting faltering demand going forward? If you're asking Powell, you know, according to his last congressional hearing, when he said the idea that deficits don't matter for countries that can borrow in their own currency is just wrong, I think US debt is fairly high at the level of GDP, and much more importantly than not, it's growing faster than GDP. So Powell clearly disagree on the view that deficits don't matter. And he's right. But only if, and this is a capital if, the deficits cause the debt ratios to increase exponentially. The point, though, is that running primary budget deficits will only cause a debt spiral if the government rolls over the existing debt at higher yields than the economy's nominal GDP growth. In other words, if a government can roll over its debt at lower yields than the economy's growth, then a fiscal impulse will cause the debt-to-GDP ratio to rise initially, but it will then stabilize at a higher level. So my point is basically that against conventional wisdom, it means that socialism would have no fiscal cost. And to basically illustrate this view, you can look at what happened in Japan, where primary budget deficits averaged 5% of GDP during the 15 years leading to the financial crisis. At that point, yields were consistently above the nominal GDP growth rate, and it caused the debt ratio to absolutely explode from 20% to almost 100% before the crisis and 140% just after the crisis. Since the global financial crisis, the BOJ and the BOJ's QE infinity and yield curve control, 10-year yields have been below GDP growth levels for most of the time, and that's actually allowed the debt-to-GDP ratio to stabilize, despite primary budget deficits that are continuously averaging around 5% over the past decade. So the bottom line is that deficits need not lead to increased taxes. In fact, public debt has no fiscal cost if yields can be kept low enough. In other words, if the central bank proves cooperative.
Okay, Juliet, but surely large deficits will lead to higher demand, inflation, and creditors demanding higher yields, which undoubtedly will trigger a debt spiral, no?
Well, actually, this is not true for a country whose central bank is credible in preserving the purchasing power of its money, and a government which can print its own currency. In fact, we'll see that the only constraint to the US ability to run large deficits is not the ability to finance the deficits, but inflationary pressures. If inflation expectations rose suddenly, there would be, as you say, a spending rush or a hurry to exchange dollar for foreign currencies in a move to preserve one's purchasing power. And of course, that would force the Fed to turn overly restrictive and restore its credibility as a purchasing power watchdog. And that would indeed push yields higher than the growth rate and sharply worsen the debt dynamic. And post-global financial crisis, it was feared that QE could only be a temporary measure because of its inflationary attributes. But this fear proved completely unfounded. You will ask me why, and that's because activating the wealth lever and waiting for positive trickling down effects to the people did not stimulate final demand, which means effectively that inflation stayed confined to asset prices and did not reach goods. And that basically kept the Fed easy and curbing expectations that rates would be low for longer. For sure, though, a more drastic helicopter money-like measures would lead to increased consumer price inflation. After all, there's really no reason why you wouldn't be able to spur spending. But if the money printed finally ended in the haves-nots hands. And I think in a way, it's the reason why it's an easy decision to choose to inflate assets rather than consumer prices, given the Fed's mandate. An efficient fiscal stimulus targeting demand rather than supply would be self-limiting in that it would eventually trigger inflation and higher rates. So in short, as long as inflation expectations are depressed, and we've seen in my last interview that it is clearly the case, central banks can monetize the government's debt, like very much like what's happening in Japan, or cap long-term yields by keeping term premium artificially depressed. The result is to make fiscal policy much more potent by suppressing price discovery. But it will be completely useless unless politicians use the opportunity to inject more so-called socialism into a fundamentally unequal system. And that would be in a view to unleash spending demand and increase macro dynamism.
Okay, Juliet, it sounds like you're saying that money-financed fiscal deficits are already the name of the game and that that can go on indefinitely until inflation picks up. So are you effectively saying that MMT is just a red herring?
Well, exactly. In my books, actually, the only difference between MMT and monetization, which, by the way, is already happening via QE infinity, is that modern monetary theory argues that government could bypass the central bank and print the money themselves by crediting accounts with government's IOUs rather than spending through deficits by creating government debt. For me, the fault in this theory is that losing the apolitical Fed as an intermediary may well stoke inflation and an FX devaluation swiftly, because you can't trust a government, naturally driven by the next election, to credibly underwrite purchasing power. However, if you get the help of a credible central bank, bond vigilantes will be powerless to bid yields up, and they will continue to finance US budget deficit on the cheap. In a world where aggregate demand has become chronically deficient, the central banker's job is to allow the government to act as a potent spender of last resort, keep yields below the nominal growth rate, whilst acting as a credibility buffer. In the end, my view is basically that people's QE might be the only path to rising inflation expectations meaningfully. I'd like to add as an aside that this has large implications for those that are worried that the US may not be able to finance the 100 trillion plus future entitlements slowly coming off on balance sheet because the population is aging. In my view, it will be financed, you know, possibly eventually by the Fed, and it's unlikely to trigger a debt crisis or dollar crash because entitlements currently off balance sheet for the government are already virtually on the consumer's balance sheet, and therefore they're unlikely to boost final demand and inflation expectations.
Juliet, I know that JDI Research is not only about getting the macro landscape understanding right, but also getting the market direction right. So as we assimilate all of these capitalism versus socialism subjects together, what do you see in terms of market implications?
So for me, from a market perspective, my conclusion would be that there is ample room for fiscal stimuli to play their part in the next downturn. And that's despite already high sovereign debt burdens. And I think the 2020 voters, especially obviously in the US, should not worry too much about higher taxes. I think Powell is wrong to think about deficits as evidence of excessive spending. A country which prints its own money has no debt problem, that is, until it has an inflation problem, which we currently do not have whatsoever. My second conclusion is that the Fed will have to accommodate growing fiscal deficits and eventually revert to suppressing price discovery completely. And that means that the extent of the curve steepening will be more limited this time than rising deficits may suggest. Last week, I actually recommended taking profit on a long three-year U.S. Treasury that I initiated in February. And that leaves me, as far as the U.S. curve is concerned, with just a 5/30 steepener. But I will be looking to increase duration again via long 30-year treasury on the current cyclical re-steepening.
Juliet, we're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time, but we really look forward to getting you back on the show in a couple of weeks for your next All-Stars appearance. Listeners, you can look forward to Professor Steve Keen on Tuesday and Kevin Muir on Friday on this week's All-Stars lineup, and that's in addition to Macro Voices and Macro Voices Energy Week coming up on Wednesday and Thursday. For Macro Voices, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. Also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.